a pause in the fighting to allow for polio vaccines.
The nine-hour humanitarian pauses begin Sunday and will continue for 3 days, with the aim of vaccinating about 640,000 children under the age of 10.
Plus, Baltic nations are shoring up NATO's eastern border.
We are doing our homework to deter aggressor country from even intention, and of course also doing our homework that we, together with our NATO allies, we strengthen our defensive.
And later, China's influence in Africa. A Ukrainian F-16 goes down, and a king has died. Today is Friday, August 30th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today with a promising development from the Middle East. That's where officials say Israel will allow a series of daily humanitarian pauses in the fighting for a large-scale polio vaccination campaign in Gaza. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell has the latest.
The nine-hour humanitarian pauses begin Sunday and will continue for 3 days, with the aim of vaccinating about 640,000 children under the age of 10, a World Health Organization official told reporters on Thursday. More than 1.2 million doses of the oral polio vaccine have been delivered to Gaza, and another 400,000 are en route. Rick Peepercorn is a WHO's representative in the Palestinian territories and spoke to reporters from Gaza.
I'm not going to say this is the ideal way forward, but this is a workable way forward. Not doing anything would be really bad. We have to stop this transmission in Gaza, and we have to avoid the transmission outside Gaza.
He said teams will begin in central Gaza and evaluate after 3 days if more time is needed. Then the teams would move south and finally north, with each area expected to take 3 to 5 days. The first polio case the exclave has seen in 25 years turned up last month. Here he is. His name is Abdul Rahman. His mother, Nevi Abdul Jedyan. He's not able to stand still, she said, or crawl like before. He was able to crawl all over the place. He's almost a year old now, and all babies should walk when they are 1 year old. But not Abdul Rahman. Not anymore. He used to walk, crawl, but not anymore.
He can't stand still or crawl like he used to. My son could crawl all around the place. He's almost a year old now, and basically all babies should walk when they're 1 year old. But not Abdul Rahman. Not anymore. He used to walk, crawl, but not anymore.
He is her only son. Polio can cause irreversible paralysis in children and is spread from person to person, mainly through feces, but also through contaminated food and water. A major problem because of Gaza's collapsed water, sewage, and sanitation systems. The virus is easily stopped through vaccination. Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, told VOA on Wednesday that the nation will support all the campaigns to bring vaccines into Gaza. VOA asked the White House how the Biden administration was pushing for this humanitarian pause. Officials said they are deeply concerned and committed to doing all we can to supporting the UN-led efforts. And a top UN official for humanitarian affairs and emergency relief stressed how dire the situation is. Joyce Musuya is acting Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator.
It forces us to ask, what has become of our basic sense of humanity?
The vaccination campaign represents a rare point of agreement in this bitter conflict, where negotiations to end the war have dragged on for months. This is unacceptable. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
In other Gaza health-related news, an Israeli missile hit a convoy carrying medical supplies and fuel to a hospital in the Gaza Strip. It killed several people from a local transportation company. Israel claimed, without offering evidence, that it opened fire after gunmen had seized the convoy. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says it's killed 5 more militants in the occupied West Bank. Israel carried out an airstrike there on Friday as its large-scale operation entered a third day. While Israel says the raids are aimed at preventing more attacks, Palestinians see them as widening the war in Gaza. For a closer look, Lori London spoke with John Linden. He's executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, to understand what's driving this operation and why now.
I mean, it's the confluence of several factors that existed before October 7th, but like so much of the pre-existing conditions before this war, everything has become accelerated and worsened due to the war. So over the last 3.5 years, really, there's been kind of increasing lawlessness, I suppose, in the north of the West Bank. So the PA has lost some of its security control over some key refugee camps in those cities and some of the cities themselves, and Jenin being the real focus. So all of this was kind of, that tinder was already there. The other factor, of course, is the settler violence, which has been increasing again over the last 3 years. And then finally, the radical increase of weapons in the West Bank. It's something that's really apparent in these kind of increasingly ungoverned spaces in the north of the West Bank. So all of that, you could have said much of the same on October 6th. And then I suppose what's happened since is just this radical increase in Israel's willingness to use extreme force, from their sense of justification being the attack that happened on October 7th. But, you know, there's other means available. And the frustration is that we've had 6 decades almost of that status quo, and Israelis and Palestinians are more insecure today than they ever have been. And yet there seems to be a feeling that simply the application of more force, whether it's coming from these militias in the West Bank or from Israel itself, is the way that they will satisfy their security or self-determination needs. And it's very frustrating, because we can just see that that's the pattern that's been repeated for so long. And it's, for me, self-evident that we need different tools and techniques based on diplomacy and engagement, because we've reached a dead end via the application of force.
And it just seems 1 week we are concerned about, and potentially could still be, an Iran retaliatory attack on Israel that they've promised that could come at any time or not. Is this a distraction? And how is this connected to what's happening in Gaza?
I'm not sure I see a connection. I mean, there's a case being made that the influx of weapons in the West Bank, which has been a real thing over recent years, that there is some sort of relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and smuggling networks over the border with Jordan. And I'm sure there is some of that happening. And we do know that Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are relatively strong in the northern West Bank, and they obviously have connections with Iran as well. So I think there are certainly people in the security sector in Israel who see this West Bank front, Gaza, everything really, Yemen, the threat from the north, as all being part of this larger sort of shadow war with Iran. And again, there is definitely truth to that. But there is also this long-running dispute and conflict with the Palestinians for over a century that precedes the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And if Iran disappeared tomorrow morning, it would still be there. Now, I don't undermine in any way the very real security concerns with regards to Iran and the threat that they present to Israel and to the region. But, you know, even just from a military perspective, there's a limit to what Israel can do. And that limit isn't discussed often enough, right? So we have the largest reserve call-up in the state's history that's been going on now for 10 months. The reserves are exhausted. They've been deployed in Gaza for such a long time. This is, you know, on the way to becoming the longest war in Israel's history. It's already the longest since 1948. And there is, as you mentioned, this threat, like at any moment, we could have a much bigger war between Israel and Hezbollah. And then, of course, there's the threat from Iran and the direct attacks that we saw back in April. And I think sober analysts need to look at this and say, you know what, we're not able to fight this multi-front war ad infinitum. And certainly if that's the only tool that we have to be able to take care of Israel's security needs, it's not sustainable over the long term for Israel to remain sort of, you know, an OECD sort of developed democracy whilst fighting that intensity of warfare. Now, I think Israel will do it if it has to do it, but there are other ways, diplomacy and partnership and security engagement with one's neighbors. And the skeleton key to all of this is the Palestinian issue. If Israel meaningfully engaged with satisfying legitimate Palestinian rights to self-determination for an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to be able to provide that level of security at Israel's closest borders, it would then unlock the ability for Israel to be at the core of this huge security network, right? Of the strongest states from an intelligence and a military perspective in the region, plus NATO partners. And if you are genuinely fearful of Iran, and there's a lot to be fearful of there, that would be this kind of steel web of security. But it's not on offer unless the Palestinian issue is sincerely engaged with. And I think anyone who cares about Israel's security and long-term viability needs to really confront this.
Lori London hosts Issues in the News here on VOA. She was speaking with John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. Reports from Ukraine are that one of the country's recently delivered F-16 fighter jets has crashed while defending against a missile attack from Russia, killing the pilot. No word yet on whether the crash was the result of enemy fire, mechanical problems, or some other cause. An investigation is underway. All this as Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin hosts Ukrainian Defense Minister Rustem Umerov at the Pentagon on Friday. Also in Ukraine, two people are dead following an overnight missile attack on the northern city of Sumy. And during the day on Friday, Russian strikes on nearby Kharkiv killed four people, including a child who was playing on the playground at the time of the attack. Elsewhere in Eastern Europe, Baltic countries are moving to protect NATO's eastern border in the face of Russian aggression. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze reports from Latvia's border with Russia.
Latvia is setting up concrete structures known as Dragon Teeth as part of a Baltic defense line along the border with Russia and Belarus. Latvia's defense minister, Andris Spruce, says the Baltic countries are making progress on a January agreement to fortify NATO's eastern flank aimed Russian aggression.
We've been under some sort of hybrid offensive already for some years in terms of disinformation campaigns, weaponization of illegal migration, the cyber attacks, some kind of incidents against critical infrastructure. We've seen it. And this, again, is one example that we are doing our homework to deter aggressor country from even intention, and of course also doing our homework that we, together with our NATO allies, we strengthen our defensive.
Spruce says Russia's invasion of Ukraine prompted Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia and Poland to bolster their defenses and strengthen their borders.
What happened in Ukraine, it provided additional experience, it provided additional resolve to do it as soon and quickly as possible. So we realize how important it is exactly to defend country and NATO territory from the very first inch of territory. So that's exactly what we are doing.
Latvia's border with Russia and Belarus extends for about 450 kilometers. Colonel Andris Rieks is with Latvia's National Armed Forces headquarters.
As a part of total defense, we have to be responsible about our part. We are relying on the NATO for sure, and also we have to do our homework. This is our homework.
Latvia's defense ministry says the country plans to invest more than $300 million over the next 5 years to fortify its border. Again, defense minister Spruce.
This year already we will be fulfilling the threshold of 3% for defense expenditure. We are among six countries which are fulfilling, let's say, that threshold.
Spruce hopes other allies will step up to invest at least 2% of their economic output on NATO defense, a guideline set by the alliance.
We see that when the war started, it was around 8-9 countries fulfilling 2% threshold. Now we see more than 20 countries. Yes, of course, we strongly advocate and motivate our partners, our allies to invest, because at the very end, it's about one NATO. It's about capability, efficiency, and strength of one NATO.
The Eastern NATO and EU frontline countries have also requested that the European Union provide financial support for building a defensive line along the EU border with Russia and Belarus, which, according to some estimates, could cost over $2.5 billion. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Latvia-Russian border.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The relationship between China and many African countries has been deepening lately, and in several ways. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear about Chinese outreach to African journalists that has many media analysts concerned, but our coverage continues with a focus on the money. Chinese lending to Africa rose for the first time in years in 2023. This according to new research by Boston University's Global Development Policy Center. VOA's Kate Bartlett reports the $4.61 billion loaned last year is still far less than China's commitments to the continent before the pandemic.
In the heady early days of Chinese President Xi Jinping's global infrastructure project, the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, China's loans to Africa surpassed $10 billion each year. That lending dropped sharply at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic and stayed low as China experienced its own economic slowdown. The decrease in loans also came as some African borrowers entered drawn-out debt overhauls. Despite China's troubles, Lucas Engel, a data analyst who co-authored the Boston University study, explains why he thinks lending was up somewhat in 2023.
The investment should be viewed in the context of China's overall economic heft and the importance China attaches to its relationship with Africa, especially strategically important long-time borrowers that China has developed close relationships with.
The Boston University paper found a couple of trends when analyzing China's loans to 8 African countries and 2 regional financial institutions last year. The researchers said one thing that was unique was that more than half the money was loaned to African multilateral banks. They said this was likely a form of risk mitigation. And Corbis van Staden, the managing editor at the China Global South Project, a think tank based in Pretoria, agreed.
So if you're lending to African multilateral institutions, that means you are in a mix of lenders, and there are de-risking mechanisms in place, partly because because the risk is also spread across many actors. If you're lending to particularly bilaterally to a government, then the risk impact is higher.
Despite this growing risk aversion, the researchers noted China was still lending to 3 major long-time borrowers: Angola, Nigeria, and Egypt. Critics have accused China of ensnaring African countries in debt traps, by which large sums owed to Chinese companies make African governments beholden to Beijing economically and politically. Another thing the Boston University research found was that China was once again committed to energy lending after a 2-year hiatus. China committed loans to 3 renewable energy projects in Africa in 2023 in solar and hydropower. This is in line with China moving away from the large infrastructure projects of the past to so-called small is beautiful projects and a green BRI. Lauren Johnston, Associate Professor of China Studies at the University of Sydney, said it was not surprising that despite the 2023 uptick, China's loans to Africa hadn't rebounded to anywhere near previous levels. She noted that initially China was financing large projects like the building of dams, roads, and railways. Now, that's done.
Maybe this is like a period of consolidating those investments rather than just carrying on and building the next big investments. A period to consolidate and grasp the economic value and embed the returns and successes and learn from any issues with those earlier loans.
Next week, Xi will address African leaders gathered in Beijing for the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Van Staden said some new loan announcements may be made, but he added a caveat.
I don't necessarily expect a single big number. I think the announcements will probably be more diffuse.
Boston University's Engel said it was difficult to estimate the volume of financing that would be announced at the summit, but he expected pledges in diverse areas of cooperation. The Chinese embassies in Pretoria and Washington, D.C. did not immediately respond to VOA's request for comment. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Beijing is sending reporters to Chinese cities to showcase culture, technology, and tourism. What's missing, say many analysts, is an uncensored picture of China and its human rights abuses. Victoria Umunga has that story.
Kenyan veteran journalist Zubeida Kananu still thinks about a trip in July that changed her worldview.
The minute you get there, you feel like you're at home, away from home.
Kananu, a news editor and the president of Kenya's Editors Guild, says she was among 5 senior journalists on a Chinese embassy-sponsored media tour.
It took us through, you know, how media has evolved in China, the new technologies that they're using, the use of AI, the use of ChatGPT in telling their story on a day-to-day basis.
Kananu wrote about Mao Zedong, the founder of communist China. Her article, published in Kenya's local daily, is one of many stories about China she has in the pipeline. The trip gave Kananu first-hand experience interacting with people in China.
They've embraced Africa in a way that I've never seen. And then they introduce you to their culture through food.
China sees these trips as key cultural exchanges. Chinese embassy spokesperson Leo Pangyu tells VOA, He says media cooperation can not only improve the level of the media itself, but also help deepen the political, economic, social and cultural exchanges and cooperation between countries. China's efforts include sponsoring press tours to China and even sending some journalists to Xinjiang, a region where Western media have accused Beijing of human rights abuses.
China literally wants to, in a very, you know, in this very dark way, take these officials and take these foreign journalists to the exact location where these human atrocities are happening. And basically, in this very censored and policed environment, tell them, look around, there's nothing to be seen here.
China has sought to boost its image abroad by developing an international media network and signing agreements with local outlets from Europe, Latin America, and Africa, according to the International Federation of Journalists. In Kenya, Beijing has set up media houses that employ hundreds of local journalists. Chinese broadcasters are aiming to compete with Western outlets with content in local languages, including Swahili.
So now they want to do something different. They want whatever they're investing to be associated with massive information and penetrate to the village level.
While Chinese-funded large infrastructure projects have been visible examples of Beijing's influence on the continent, hosting local journalists from around the world, say experts, is a more subtle soft power approach. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally today, in New Zealand, they're mourning the death of the Maori king, Tuheitia. He died Friday morning after undergoing heart surgery, according to a statement released by his representatives. Reuters' Ryan Chang has that story.
New Zealand's Maori king, Tuheitia, died peacefully on Friday at the age of 69. He'd been recovering from heart surgery, according to a spokesperson, and his death came just days after he celebrated the 18th anniversary of his coronation. Local media say he'll be taken to his home meeting place, Tarangawaewae Marae. His tangi hanga, or funeral rites, are expected to last at least 5 days. The movement to establish a Maori monarch, or Kingitanga, began in 1858 in an attempt to unite the indigenous tribes of New Zealand under a single leader to strengthen their resistance to colonialism. The monarch is considered the paramount chief of several tribes, or iwi, but is not affiliated with all of them. The Maori king's role in New Zealand is largely ceremonial, with no judicial or legal authority.
Kia ora, good morning, everybody.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Christopher Luxon said the country will mourn King Tuheitia.
Our country will be in mourning. He was a fantastic king. He was king for 18 years. He did a lot to strengthen the kingitanga, and we're going to miss him, sadly.
According to Radio New Zealand, heads of tribes associated with the King Movement will appoint a new leader on the day of King Tuheitia's funeral.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us today, and that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.